Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
a short story by Edgar Allan Poe called The Oval Portrait. Now, I was struggling there to actually know whether Edgar Allan Poe's American or British, and why would someone in a science podcast, theme podcast, be reading this? Well, it turns out that the history of science, in terms of education science, really starts around 1830 and 1836, around that sort of time, where we invented the word scientist. It's the Victorian invention of the Industrial Revolution. But it also turns out that this actually predates the invention of English as a subject. Before we studied English, the general idea was that you could get what you needed by studying religion in either Oxford or Cambridge. So a lot of English literature or the analysis of English literature is of the 20th century, around that period here, and they have a lot of machinery and concepts which would deal with an education system which is, we can do the sciences okay, but our literature and text and the way that we organise ourselves has got woeful problems. So this is why I'm studying English literature, at least the theory of English literature, and seeing how this reads directly across to, rather than analysing poets, you can do a similar thing to analyse the motivation for people writing textbooks. I suppose, unlike the great writers, the textbooks have vital flaws which can confuse the learned reader as they go through, but it's all a shoe-through for the people who are practicing teaching. So this is why I'm reading this text, this portrait, because this is a key piece of English literature which conveys a message. So a conceptual message, and it's put in a certain way, and so it's a long bow to draw, but you can sort of work it back to see why people teach a certain amount of science, to convey a certain sort of message. And perhaps English literature is actually provides a sort of a deeper insight. Okay, so let's read this. Edgar Allan Poe, The Oval Portrait. The chateau into which my valet had ventured to make forcible entrance, rather than permit me, in my desperately wounded condition, to pass the night in the open air, was one of those piles of commingled gloom and grandeur which have so long frowned amongst the Apennines, not less in the fact than in fancy of Mrs. Ratcliffe, whoever that person is. To all appearance, it had been temporarily and very lately abandoned. We established ourselves in one of the smallest and least sumptuously furnished apartments. It lay in a remote turret of the building. Its decorations were rich, yet tattered and antique. Its walls were hung with tapestries and bedecked with manifold and multiform armorial trophies, together with an unusually great number of very spirited modern paintings in frames of rich golden arabesque. In these paintings, which depended on the walls not only for their main surfaces, but very many nooks which the bizarre architecture of the chateau rendered necessary. In these paintings, my insipid delirium, perhaps, had caused me to take deep interest, so that I bade Pedro to close the heavy shutters of the room, since it was already night, to light the tongues of a tall candelabrum which stood at the head of my bed, and to throw open, far and wide, the fringed curtains of the black velvet which enveloped the bed itself. I wished all this done that I might resign myself, not to sleep, at least alternately, to the contemplation of these pictures, and the perusal of a small volume in which had been found upon the pillow and which purported to criticize and describe them. Long, long I read, and devotedly I gazed. Rapidly and gloriously the hours flew by, and the deep midnight came. The position of the candelabrum displeased me, and outreaching my hand with difficulty, rather than disturb my slumbering valet, I placed it, as to throw its rays more fully upon the book. But the action produced the effect altogether unanticipated. The rays of numerous candles, for there were many, now fell within a niche of the room which had hitherto been thrown into deep shade by one of the bedposts. Thus I saw a vivid light, a picture all unnoticed before. It was the portrait of a young girl just ripening into womanhood. I glanced at the painting hurriedly and then closed my eyes. Why I did this was not at first apparent even to my own perception. But my lids remained thus shut. I ran over my mind my reason for shutting them. It was an impulsive movement to gain time for thought, to make sure that my vision had not deceived me, to calm and subdue my fancy for a more sober and more certain gaze. In a very few moments, I again looked fixedly at the painting. That one I saw all right. I could not and would not doubt for the first flash of the candles of the canvas upon the canvas had seemed to dissipate the dreamy stupor which was stealing over my senses and to startle me at once into waking life. The portrait, I have already said, was that of a young girl. It was a mere head and shoulders, done in what was technically termed a vignette manner, which in the style of my favourite heads of Sully. The arms, the bosoms, and even the ends of the radiant hair melted imperceptibly into the vague yet deep shadow which formed the background of the whole. The frame and oval, richly gilded and filigreed with moresque. As a thing of art, nothing could be more admirable. Oh, God. So I'm under the light in the shade here, and there's... Sorry, these huge bugs are coming. This huge bee. Oh, look. Well, there you go. Come on, off you go. That is Australian nightlife. This beetle, it was have to be an inch large. Just zoomed in on me. Okay. As a thing of art, nothing could be more admirable than the painting itself. But it could have been neither the execution of the work nor the immortal beauty of the countenance which had so suddenly and so vehemently moved me. But least of all, could it have been my fancy for shaken from the half-slumber and had mistaken the head for that of a living person. I saw at once that the peculiarities of the design of the vignette and of the frame must have instantly dispelled such an idea, must have prevented even its momentary entertainment. Thinking earnestly upon these points, I remained for an hour perhaps, half sitting, half reclining, with my vision riveted upon the portrait. At length, satisfied with the true secret of the effect, I fell back within the bed. I had found the spell of the picture in the absolute life-likeness of the expression, which, at first startling, finally confounded, subdued, and appalled me. With deep and reverent awe, I replaced the candelabrum in its former position. The cause of my deep agitation being thus shut from my view, I saw eagerly the volume which discussed the paintings and their histories. Turning to the number which designated the oval portrait, I there read a vague and quaint words which follows. And the rest is a quote. She was a maiden of the rarest beauty, and not more lovely than full of gleam. And the evil of the hour when she saw and loved and wedded the painter was the hour when she saw and loved and wedded the painter. He, passionate, studious, austere, and having already a bride in his art. She, a maiden of the rarest beauty, and not more lovely than full of glee, all light and smiles, and frogs and the young, as the young fawn, loving and cherishing all things, hating only the art which was her rival, dreading only the palette of the brushes and other untoward instruments which deprived her of countenance of her lover. It was thus a terrible thing for the lady to hear the painter speak of his desire to portray even his young bride. But she was humble and obedient, and she sat meekly for many weeks in the dark turret chamber, where the light dripped upon the pale canvas only from overhead. But he, the painter, took glory in his work, and went on from hour to hour, from day to day. And when he was passionate and wild and moody man, who came lost in the reveries so that he would not see the light which fell so ghastly on the lone turret within, withered and the health and the spirits of her bride, who pined visibly all, to all but him. Yet she smiled on and still on, uncomplaining, because she saw that the painter, who had high renown, took a fervid and burning pleasure at his task, and walked day and night to depict her who so loved him, yet who grew daily more dispirited and weak. And in the sooth, some who beheld the portrait spoke of its resemblance in low words as a mighty marvel, and proof not less of the power of the painter than of his deep love for whom he depicted so surpassingly well. But at length, as the labour drew nearer to its conclusion, there was submitted none to the turret, for the painter had grown wild with the ardour of his work, and turned his eye from the canvas rarely, even regarding the countenance of his wife. And he would not see that the tints which he spread upon the canvas were drawn from the cheeks of her who sat beside him. And when many weeks passed, and but little remained to do, save one brush upon the mouth and one tint upon the eye, the spirit of the lady again flickered up as the flame within the socket of the lamp. And when the brush was given, and when the tint was placed, and for one moment the painter stood enhanced before the work which he had wrought, but in the next, while yet he gazed, she drew a tremendous and very pallid aghast, crying in a loud voice, "This is indeed life itself!" Turned suddenly with regard to his beloved. She was dead. Okay, so this is the Edgar Allan Poe thing of art resembling life and actually killing life itself by being so obsessed with the obsession. And so there are these issues in science, I know it sounds so, science education, in that we are so interested in replicating our artist view of science, reproducing science, that we actually kill our students, our interests of our students going ahead. And of course this is but one of the reference works in the textbooks, which I'm just now working my way through. And of course it's hard for me because I read it through and I go through and I say, oh, I have forgotten this various pages. But it is very interesting because there is the same characters who appear in as reference for English literature are the self same characters for people who are deep in the formation of science. So Aristotle wrote about literature, and so did Plato, and so did Coleridge. And Coleridge is a key critique. So he not only wrote poetry, but understood the theory of poetry when he wrote it. And he is the person who chided Whewell to actually invent the word scientist. So this is all commingled, and in terms of messages, there are these beautiful messages out there in English literature and the analysis of English literature, which is decidedly a modern event. So English literature wasn't taught at Oxford and Cambridge until 1911, 1921, because it was thought redundant, because we could just teach all the things that we're attempting to teach in English with religion. And so it's these schools which suddenly had an explosion of analysis, which may help us unlock the quandary we have, because, I mean, we have an issue here that a lot of the stuff in our textbooks we are teaching our kids is wrong, and the way that we're teaching them kills their ability to be alive in terms of science. It's not that they should be able to do science, replicate science, recite science. It should be part of their life, that their experience of clouds, of light. It should be part of the wonder of the world. And in that sense, we are creating a portrait of science, but actually not the actual life of science. Thanks for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.